I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to The Connection. Last year, the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, sounded the alarm about an epidemic of loneliness and isolation that was putting Americans' physical and mental health at risk. He went on to declare that individual relationships are an untapped resource, a source of healing that's hiding in plain sight. He had several suggestions. Answer that phone call from a friend. Make time to share a meal. But how many of us have a close friend with whom we can be both intimate and vulnerable? According to a recent American Perspective survey, 12% of the public say they have no friends, which is a sad and growing trend. Today on The Connection, why we need friends more than ever. Let me introduce our guests. Marissa Franco is a national speaker. She's also a University of Maryland psychologist who's been studying friendship for years. Her book, Platonic, The Surprising New Science of How to Make and Keep Friends as Adults, is about the value of this overlooked and life-sustaining relationship. Marissa Franco, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Hi, nice to be here.
Very nice to have you with us. And also with us is Raina Cohen. And she asks in her new book, The Other Significant Others, what if friendship became the center of our life? She's a producer and editor for NPR's podcast Embedded. And Raina Cohen, nice to have you with us on The Connection as well.
Nice to be here and also in conversation with Marissa.
And I should say to our listeners, and we did not intend this when we booked the two of you, you are friends, which actually makes this conversation even better. And I wonder if I could put to each of you, and Raina, I'll start with you. How would you describe your relationship with Marissa?
I think Marissa and I have multiple layers to our friendship and also our professional relationship. We met in a setting where we first started talking about the fact that we were both working on books on friendship. This was years ago. And I think we've kind of counseled each other in different forms. I mean, Marissa's book has been a hit, and it came out about a year and a half before mine. So she has guided me through this process. And we've also been able to be sort of intellectual partners in the different writing projects that we've worked on and given feedback and helped each other think differently or, you know, see new sides of the whatever topic it was we were working on in a given chapter of our books. So, and then we have, you know, our fun social time and increasingly overlapping social world. So there are a lot of dimensions to our friendship.
Marissa, how would you describe your friendship with Raina?
Raina is someone I really respect and admire. I feel like she has taught me so much. And I think what stands out to us, even though we both write books on friendship, you can perceive those as in competition with each other, but it's always felt like we've been rooting for each other to succeed.
Which is really important. And I think, Marissa, really a part of friendship, right? Which is that you are not in competition with that other person. You are rooting for their success.
Absolutely. Yeah. When you get close to people, you begin to include them in your sense of yourself. So helping them feels like helping yourself.
What does, I'll go back to you, Marissa, but then Raina, I'll get you back in on the conversation. But Marissa, what does friendship give us that we don't get from a partnered relationship? And I do think there are some things in common, but some things that are really unique.
Yeah, so this is so interesting because recently I was lamenting to a friend about how another friend tends to really prioritize romantic partnerships and I don't see her. And she said something so profound. She was like, you know, if we really knew ourselves beyond what society tells us we should know about ourselves, we would all know it would be self-evident that we need an entire community for ourselves. And I think that's so clear because each person brings out a different side of us. And so to experience the fullness of who we are, we need to find ourselves beyond one particular person and in larger community.
And to you, Raina, a different way of asking the same question, but I hear this kind of embedded in both of your answers, whether we really give friendship the value that it deserves in our lives.
I think we don't. And that's one thing that Marissa and I are trying to change. You know, what I am seeing as I'm having conversations out in the world with people now that the book has been released is how much individually people really do value their friendships, but don't necessarily feel like that is recognized by other people. So they don't talk about their friendships to the same, you know, degree that actually matches their affection and, you know, admiration for their friends. So there's a bit of a gap between, I think, how people experience friendship as being really, really meaningful and the societal messaging that tells us that a romantic relationship relationship, and familial relationships are really the ones that matter. I mean, you know, there are certainly people who don't care about their friends as much or see them as disposable, or, you know, kind of walk away to prioritize a romantic relationship. But I, you know, I think whether people have close friendships or not, there's increasing understanding, thanks to, you know, the Surgeon General making clear with the loneliness epidemic that people need friends, and books like Marissa's, that, you know, friends matter, and it is okay to vocalize that your friends matter.
Well, in fact, in your book, Raina, you talk about a friend who you describe as M with a letter M, and you describe meeting her, and I would say falling in love with her. Tell us about your relationship with M.
I think saying that I fell in love with M is very accurate. I mean, that's really how it felt. And that's also the place where many of the beginning questions that turned into this book came from. So she and I met and just immediately clicked. And in fact, before we had any conversation, I spotted her across the room and just noticed the way that she carried herself and like had this kind of desire to strike up conversation with her. She seemed, you know, charismatic and interesting, even from afar. And because we lived only a 5-minute walk away from each other, we were able to be really enmeshed in each other's lives quickly. We didn't have to kind of, you know, ask, oh, do you want to get lunch 3 weeks from now? There was just so much convenience that we were able to hang out with each other at the end of the day or before going to work. And particularly in the first couple of years of our friendship, when we lived so close by, I felt like our friendship rose to a level of partnership, that even best friend was actually not quite the right label. So, you know, I think both in our day-to-day lives and the emotional experience felt so similar to me to a romantic partnership, but it didn't have the sexual desire that, you know, has accompanied romantic relationships in my experience.
Is there a word for this kind of relationship? You struggle in your book finding the right words to describe these kinds of intense friendships.
You know, I use the term platonic partnership as a way to create a label that feels like it would be pretty encompassing of the different types of relationships that fit. The first one I will say that resonated with me is actually a historical term called romantic friendship. Mm-hmm. And it's a term for really intimate, affectionate same-sex friendships that were common up until about the turn of the 20th century. And, you know, one of the features of my friendship with M is how, you know, like, We use lots of terms of endearment, and we're very physically affectionate, and we're very sort of sweet with each other in a way that feels like it has these elements of romance. So, you know, to me, the term romantic friendship is actually something that fits quite nicely. But I think probably a term that would fit more types of people, because not everybody has that kind of, you know, emotional element, would be platonic partnership, because that really captures the commitment that's possible to find within a platonic relationship.
Let me go back to you, Marissa. And as you both are talking, and especially as Raina is talking, thinking about those childhood friendships we had that were so intense and so all-encompassing and so important in our lives. What can we learn from kids about friendship?
Oh, my gosh. Kids are
the best.
So great. Yes. At friendship. Well, I think the first thing that we can learn from kids is that they have infrastructure for friendship like we as an adult don't have. Rebecca G. Adams says, when we have repeated unplanned interaction and shared vulnerability, friendship does happen more organically. And that's school, right? We see each other at school every day when we're kids, and we can be vulnerable. But at work, we often don't feel comfortable being vulnerable. And we don't inhabit any environments which provide us these ingredients for friendship to happen more organically. So we can add that infrastructure to our adult lives and find that friendship moves more easily by joining a retreat, by joining a class, for example. The other thing that I wanted to share was just related to Raina's story, because I think Raina's thoughts on friendship have had a profound impact on me too. I interviewed her on her book. And one of the things she said was like, and I'm going to share this, Raina, because you told me I could before, was that when deciding, her and her husband were deciding to move in with friends, she was concerned about not saving enough money because they were moving into a house. And her husband asked her, well, is the down payment to not saving enough money, is that more important than community?
Right.
And I keep asking, and I had to ask myself that question when my best friend moved to New York and there were rats all over her apartment and cockroaches. And I asked myself, should I invite her to stay with me in DC indefinitely in my one bedroom? And that would be tight and that might be uncomfortable in some ways and we might wake each other up. But I asked myself, like, are those inconveniences more important than community with my friend? And so, because of Raina's work, I've had a kind of mini platonic life partnership for 3 weeks. She just left to London earlier this week and it was beautiful. It was really, really beautiful. So, Raina, thank you so much for your work. It's already impacted me.
And just to dig
Oh.
into your story there, Raina, you and your husband live with two close friends, and I think they're two children. And you live all together in a I guess a house or an apartment. What do you get from by having close friends so close? What do you get from it that
I
maybe you
think
don't
even
get from your husband?
well, I've learned so much about these friends in a way that would be impossible if we didn't spend this much time together. You know, one of them officiated the wedding between my husband and me, so is somebody who's very important in my life. But I feel like at the point at which she officiated our wedding, you know, years ago, I knew so much less about her than I do now, and I didn't realize how little I actually understood about her. You know, when you are watching people make decisions day to day and you're seeing people, you know, when they're exhausted or when they've had the best news that's just come through, and you're, you know, my housemates are both, they just sort of got through the academic job market process. So, you know, I was helping them with their job market papers and like did some practice interviews, and they did practice interviews with me to, you know, prep me for podcasts. And there are ways that we support each other and get to really intimately know what we're working on, what we're thinking about, the, you know, decisions that we're grappling with related to, in their case, parenting or family or the friends in their lives, or, you know, religion is a big one because they're observant Jews and I didn't, you know, grew up relatively secular. So I just feel like there are, you know, so many levels on which I know them, and it would be very hard to get there if I didn't see them day to day for, at this point, years. And I also have a, you know, close relationship with their friends. In terms of, you know, what is different from what I get from my husband, I guess I don't think of it in, as a like they're filling in a hole or that there's some kind of you know, it's like either or that. I mean, my husband loves these kids and loves our friends, and I get to see different sides of him when he's playing with the, you know, 3-year-old or 10-month-old. I, you know, see hit like my friends ask him different questions, or they, you know, they bring out different sides of him. So all this actually kind of works together. And I guess on a practical level, I have more support. Like when I needed help in the middle of the day and my husband was off at the office and my housemates were working from home, like I could go to them or I could share, you know, exciting news with them. There's just like an abundance of people around to share life with.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our guest. That's Raina Cohen, and she's got a new book. It's called The Other Significant Others Begin, excuse me, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. Also with us, Marissa Franco, and her book is Platonic, The Surprising New Science of How to Make and Keep Friends as Adults. And yes, we are talking about friends and friendship today on The Connection. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Today on The Connection, why we need friends not just when we're kids, but as adults, how they enrich our lives, how they can support us in our marriages and partnerships, and why they are good for our mental and physical health. Our guests are psychologist Marissa Franco and journalist Raina Cohen. Marissa, let me go back to you, and here's a really basic question, but as adults, how do we make friends? See, I mean, it seems we should know this by now, but nonetheless, since we're really dissecting what friendship is, how do we do that, especially as adults?
Yeah, so the first thing we need to do is let go of the idea that it's going to happen organically, which research actually links to being lonelier over time, whereas people that see it as making, as taking effort are less lonely over time. So we are going to have to initiate with people. Now, when I say that, people say they're really afraid of rejection. So I like to tell them about research on something called the liking gap, which finds that when strangers interact, they actually underestimate how liked they are. So people are actually far less likely to reject us than we think they do, which is why I tell people, try to assume people are going to like you. If you make that assumption, how would you navigate new and forthcoming friendships? And I say this based off of research on something called the acceptance prophecy. This finding that when people are told that they are liked, they go into groups and become more likable. They're more friendly, they're more open. Whereas when you think about when we think we're going to be rejected, we reject people, we come off as cold, we come off as withdrawn. I think low-hanging fruit is to reconnect with people, initiate an active reconnection. And again, research finds people enjoy that more than we predict. But if you really want to create your sturdier network, just like I said earlier, you want to think about having repeated unplanned interaction and shared vulnerability. So I tell people to join something that's repeated over time. So instead of joining a language workshop, join a language class, because you capitalize on something called the mirror exposure effect, which is our unconscious tendency to like people who are familiar to us. So when we see people repeatedly, we like them more, even if we have not talked to each other. And another implication of that effect is that when you first interact with people, it's going to be uncomfortable. We are wired to be uncomfortable around what is unfamiliar. People often say, you know, I joined the book club, the first club, it was weird. I didn't really talk to anyone, right? But once they stick it out, they find that they feel more comfortable and other people feel more comfortable. And just one last tip for you, because sure, I think some people are going to join that club and wait for people to approach them. You have to overcome something called covert avoidance, which means you show up and you check out, you show up and you're on your phone, you show up and you're talking to the one person you already know. You have to introduce yourself to people, say, hi, I'm Marissa. How have you enjoyed the book? Would love to hear more about it.
I mean, it is, in a way, with all those psychological caveats, saying to someone, will you be my friend?
Yeah.
I want you to be my friend.
Yeah. Like, I have to show interest in other people and initiate and not just be passive and wait for it to happen, because up to 50% of us are lonely. If we kind of just go with the culture, we're going to be one of those people.
Well, and Raina, I read a number of statistics. I quoted one in the introduction to the show about the numbers of people in this country, but I also think in other countries as well, that say either I don't have a close friend or I don't have any friends or people that they would consider to be friends. And I find that really worrisome on so many different levels. And it seems like it even predates the pandemic. What do you think is going on here from your perspective?
I think we've been given a sense of what a good life is, which is, you know, where a romantic relationship is the thing you are striving for if you want to be seen as having succeeded. And career is a big factor, and having kids or tending to family. And friendship, I think, for a lot of people, and what we're told anyway, is a nice to have and not need to have. And that leads to, you know, a world where people are not necessarily pursuing their friends. But I also think that the skills, like the ones that Marissa is talking about around initiating, you know, around like asking people really bluntly to be your friend, which I've had people do, and I've basically done the same. They're not things that we're taught. And friendship is really, you know, is much more ambiguous. There isn't a social script. So if we aren't practicing this, if we're not talking as a culture, we're not learning in school that this is an important kind of relationship that's going to take work, and that you know, need to be vulnerable in, then you have the situation where people are like, you know, at age 30, 40, 50, how do you make friends? Which, you know, it makes sense if we're not told from, you know, the time that we're very young that this is something that we need to work on, that it's just not going to pan out.
Well, I'm thinking too, Marissa, I mean, I think all of us who have friends, I mean, there's some friends that really are these intimate people with whom we do share our secrets and other things in our lives. And then there are other people that are more casual. Is it important to have this kind of nice diverse selection of friends depending on what we need and who we're with?
I think you said it perfectly. The research finds that the quality of friendship is more important than the quantity, but that it also depends on our age. So around mid-20s, when people are trying to expand their sense of identity, we see that they have the largest network of friends. Whereas as they get older, they're thinking, how much time do I have left? And so they want to spend it with the relationships that are truly meaningful. And so a pruning process tends to happen later in life, where our social networks become smaller, but we also become more satisfied because our goals change at different age points.
I wonder too, and Marissa, I'll go back to you about social media or the pandemic. I mean, I think that really has scrambled life for so many people in so many different ways. People that, you know, move around the country for work and other reasons. How much you think that has just made it harder for us to literally meet people and have face-to-face conversations?
Oh, it has made it hard. I teach a class on loneliness, and we study why did we start being so lonely, and people thought it happened during the pandemic, but it happened with the television, actually, in the 1950s. That's when we started to see these trends, because people wouldn't get bored enough to have to interact with others. They now had entertainment. Before that, leisure time was spent with others. Now it's spent in your four walls. And I very sadistically assign my Gen Z students to spend a day without their phones to see how it impacts.
How does that work out? Right.
They get so bored that they're like, I started talking to people. I was desperate for social interaction. And what I realize, interestingly, is that I think we often think that like rates of loneliness are too high. But what I think is actually we're not letting ourselves experience loneliness enough. Loneliness is becoming not fully digested. We're short circuiting it through technology, through those pseudo interactions. So we don't get into a place where loneliness becomes a full alarm bell to tell us, hey, I need to reach out to people. Hey, I need connection.
Well, I'm thinking of loneliness, and I just scribbled the word boredom. I mean, how does that factor in, Marissa?
Yeah, I mean, I think being bored spurs us to do a lot of things that are in our best interest, like making friends, you know, like in places where people are bored, they're spending their time connecting with other people. Like my mom is from Haiti. And when I used to go there, I would just marvel at how, wow, people just spend their free time, like hanging out on people's porches and talking to each other. And so I think with the absence of boredom, we used to try to entertain ourselves through other people, but now we're trying to entertain ourselves via our screens.
Well, and I mean, I use a screen, I think, as much as anyone else, Raina. And on one hand, yes, it probably does disconnect me with some of the people in my life, but it also does connect me with other people in my life, but probably in a very different kind of way. Your thoughts?
I think what matters is how you're using technology. Are you using it as a replacement for going out in the world and, you know, having conversations at a book club? Or are you using it as a way to connect yourself for offline activities or to, you know, kind of maintain ties until you can see each other in person? I mean, I've been, you know, I use WhatsApp, I use voice memos, I, you know, email a lot of people, but it's often because me and the other person are not in the same place, or I want to have some kind of interim connection, or we're planning something. So I, you know, I've gotten into the loops where I'm maybe using technology as a way to, you know, not pay attention to my boredom, as Marissa's talking about. But I think it can be great if you are using it to connect more deeply offline. And I will say, maybe to the horror of your Gen Z students, Marissa, I take a day off of technology every week. And that's really important for me as a day to connect and to, you know, reset my mind. And it very much is important for my social life to not be on screens at that kind of regular frequency.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Raina Cohen. She's got a brand new book. It's called The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. And Marissa Franco is our other guest. And she wrote a book called Platonic, The Surprising New Science of How to Make and Keep Friends as Adults. Marissa, you've said this several times about sort of having unscripted time together. I mean, I think often we make plans to go to the movies or go out to dinner or to go to a concert or do something with someone else. How important is it just to do nothing or have no particular plans for friendship?
You mean like having unscripted plans with other people?
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? I actually want to lob this question over to Raina because she has an amazing Atlantic article about this topic.
Go ahead, Raina.
That's very sweet, Marissa. I wrote about this in terms of what adults can learn from kids' friendships. And one thing that kids have is, you know, not just they have the repeated interaction that Marissa was talking about earlier at school, but they also, I think, have a different relationship with time than adults do, where they, you know, we'll just go and hang out. And that is the activity. And they're going to fill that time, whether it is, you know, 15 hours that are involved in a sleepover or spending time together, you know, in a just hanging out at someone's house. And that's something that I think few adults do, where instead they slot their friends into these little you know, bits of their calendar where they will get lunch or dinner or coffee. And, you know, maybe they'll go on a hike or something, but they're really planned. And there's sort of an activity in the center. And I'm actually right now getting to experience what more childlike form of friendship looks like with this unscripted time, because I'm currently in a house with about 20 friends and friends of friends, and there's a lot of just like playfulness, and we'll figure out what we want to do in the evenings, but sometimes people will come up with wacky things as they did last night, but often we're just like, okay, let's go on a walk for a while, or you know, we're in the mountains right now, let's go snowshoeing, or let's, you know, just I with my friend, we just ended up in a snowball fight the other day, and we're then sat down and like threw snowballs at tree trunks while we talk to each other. And those, you know, both create memories, which I think are really important, and also just like leave a lot of room to see each other in these different dimensions, which has come up at different points in this conversation, that I think seeing people in their playful side, their intellectual side, learning about, you know, what is most vulnerable or feels most vulnerable to them, like all of that can come out when you're not slotting each other in for, you know, hour long settings where you just have to tick through your most recent days or weeks.
In fact, that reminds me of a wonderful quote from The Little Prince. It is the time you have wasted for your rose or your friend that makes them so important. Just to kind of underscore what you were saying there, Raina. Let me go back to you, Marissa, because I do want to talk about the workplace. We spend, you know, even if we're remote, we spend a lot of time at work, often have more time with our work people than we do with our friends or even our family outside of work. How do you see work as a place to really develop intense, close friendships?
Yeah, so it's interesting, like related to the ingredients for friendship to happen, the repeated unplanned interaction and shared vulnerability. I think about that as a possibility in the workplace, but then I've come across another study that found that the more time we spent together at work, the less close we feel. All right. And what I think is happening is that often in work, we are showing one dimension of ourselves, just like my work persona, and it doesn't actually make us feel close to each other unless we can begin to be more fully who we are. And that is, of course, contingent on being in a workplace that welcomes that, particularly for people of marginalized groups. But I think one secret that I have for people trying to make friends at work is that you have to stop talking about work. You have to start talking about who you are outside of work, your hobbies, your interests, and show interest in who people are outside of the job too. Because when you're only one dimension of each other to each other, the capacity to form connection becomes much more limited.
And you have said this several times about for I guess, deep friendships, this notion of being vulnerable, of being intimate, of being disclosing, that creates this, go ahead, Marissa, but creates this, you know, for lack of a better word, intense connection.
It really does. And I think some of us think if we're vulnerable, people are going to see us as weak when we see that intimate self-disclosure is linked to being liked more by other people. There's a phenomenon called the beautiful mess effect, this finding that when we're vulnerable, we predict people will judge us more than they actually will, because we underestimate how authentic and honest we come off. You know, basically when it comes to friendship, there's this theory called the theory of inferred attraction, which is people like people that they think like them. And what vulnerability does is it says to someone, I trust you. You are special to me in that you make me feel comfortable enough to open up and to share these parts of myself. We confide in that person, we unload, and we feel better ourselves. And a lot of things that make us feel good, we associate with that person. Like if I'm having a positive experience, I feel more positively about the person I'm having that experience with.
Earlier, Raina, you were talking about this really intense friendship you have with a woman who you describe as M, with the letter M. And over time, that intensity kind of dissipates. And I think for some people, you lose a friendship because they moved away, or there's some kind of a rift, or you just sort of grow in different directions. But that doesn't mean it isn't sad, and we don't grieve some of those losses. And you write, again, very intensely about M and sort of what happened to your relationship.
Yeah, I mean, it actually took me quite a while to even understand and I think validate my own feelings around how hard it was when our relationship changed, which was partly linked to her moving to a different country for a couple of years and reorienting, you know, her social life and some of her priorities. And I felt like, you know, how could I feel bad about a friendship that was so close and is still close, but just not quite as close as it was before? Will anybody understand it? And, you know, I also had trouble because it wasn't like we'd had a falling out and there was some clear break, but instead it was a change not in kind, but kind of in degree of our friendship, which I, as I started working on this chapter, would later learn is a form of ambiguous loss, that there, you know, when there isn't this kind of clear break that leads to, you know, a clear break, it's less clear than how you were supposed to feel about it, or even to recognize that it is legitimate to grieve. And I can tell you that lots of people have had versions of this. We don't live in a society that even talks about friend breakups or falling outs or transitions in a way that would make anybody feel validated, I think, if they have this kind of friendship loss. And I've had people come up to me crying or, you know, with tears in their eyes, talking about a friendship that they miss. And, you know, no one's coming to their house with Ben and Jerry's or with a card that says, sorry, you had a friend breakup, in a way that, you know, somebody might come to their rescue and try to support them after a romantic relationship loss. So I really think of losses in friendship as having these two painful layers. One is not having the person in your life in the way that they once were and not being able to sort of look toward the future that you had imagined for each other. And then on top of that, the sense that it's not going to be supported or recognized, maybe even by yourself. So it just makes that loss all the more painful.
And we're almost up on a break here. Any quick comment, Marissa? I mean, what Raina said tells us a lot, which is that we just don't put friendship on a high enough plane to be able to acknowledge the grief when it's lost.
Exactly. And, you know, intimacy is intimacy. A relationship is a relationship. It's every bit as valid to feel grief at the loss of a friendship than a romantic relationship or a familial relationship, right? We can't pretend that friendship is compartmentalized out of the consolation of intimacy.
Well, let's take that very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Marissa Franco. She's a psychologist at the University of Maryland. She's a national speaker, wrote a book called Platonic, The Surprising New Science of How to Make and Keep Friends as Adults. Raina Cohen is a producer, editor for NPR's podcast Embedded, and she's got a brand new book. I have it right here, The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. With fewer people getting married or marrying later in life, also high divorce rates and a loneliness epidemic, maybe it's time to rethink the value of friendship and what it takes to make friends and sustain these relationships as adults. Talking with psychologist Marissa Franco and with journalist Raina Cohen. Let me go back to you, if I could, Marissa, and just picking up on these rifts that can happen in a friendship or in any relationship. Broadly speaking, are friends conflict averse, sort of more likely to well, let me get my other words out, but I hear you. More likely to kind of overlook a problem or address it head on. Go ahead.
Oh my gosh, we so ignore conflict with our friends, and friendships end because we never make the unsaid said, because we don't think that that is acceptable or normal when, again, in any relationship of intimacy, we are going to have to talk through things. Recently, I've had this experience where I had to express a need to a friend, and it felt so foreign and so scary for me as someone who understands the importance of these things intellectually, but felt like I was violating some deep social norm to say, hey, friend, I need this from you. I need you to show up. I can't just be chill about this because I've tried to be chill about it anymore and it's causing a rift between us. And to say that explicitly, and you know, it makes me sad because I honestly remember reading a study, I couldn't cite it off the top of my head, that when women share expectations for friendships, their friends rise to it, whereas when men do, their friends do not. It seems in this case my friend is rising through the experience, and also we're appreciating the conflict as a moment of mutual discovery, like our needs to share more deeply who we are, right? Where does this need come from? Why do I need it? They show us how to love our friends more deeply. And me talking about going through these conflicts with my friends leads other friends to say, maybe I shouldn't have given up more so easily. Maybe I shouldn't have just let it go. Maybe if I was able to actually address the conflict, we'd still be able to be as close. And I would argue even closer when you find that someone is willing to show up for you and love you in the ways that you tell them you need to be loved.
And I do want to talk about men and women, but let me just go back to you just quickly, Marissa. As you said, this felt like a scary conversation to have. I mean, conflict is hard, but do you think uniquely scary when a friendship is involved?
I do, because it feels like a violation. It feels like you're doing something that is socially unacceptable. And so there's the extra baggage of that. And I think in romantic partnerships, there's this narrative and this norm of we're gonna fight and get back together. And that's what marriage is. But in friendship, that's not necessarily the norm. So it feels like you're jumping off a cliff. You're like, is my friend gonna leave me, abandon ship from this relationship because I brought up this, because it's not normal for them to stay committed despite when issues come up between us. But what we do see in the research is that when we tend to have these conflicts more openly and in a non-blaming, non-attacking way, that there actually tends to be more intimacy in the relationship. I'm reminded of terms by psychoanalyst Virginia Goldner, who talks about how we can have this flaccid safety where we feel safe because nobody's bringing up any issues, or this dynamic safety of rupture and repair and rupture and repair and knowledge that we're in this no matter what comes up.
Do you want to weigh in on this, Raina, about conflict and handling conflict among friends?
I mean, I completely agree with everything Marissa said about how people expect things to go totally unsaid within friendship. And what I'm reminded of is a comment by somebody who I interviewed in the book who has one of these exceptionally close friendships, which is really at odds with the way that he grew up. And he was told that if you are talking about a friendship, you're trying too hard. it's, you know, which I think is kind of related to the idea that friendship is not that important of a relationship. So why would you be all, you know, turned out, like bent out of shape about it? And why would you be dealing with conflict? I think that it is pretty typical for people to say, if this friendship has any conflict in it or difficulty, it's not worth having. Whereas in a romantic relationship, there's a sense that there's going to be at least some point of disagreement or communication that you're going to need to have together. So I think we could all stand to treat friendship with the kind of seriousness of other close relationships, and that all close relationships are going to have some kind of difficulty that you need to work through. And those are not necessarily signs of weakness, but actually can be, as you know, Marissa is talking about, these opportunities to build more closeness rather than abandon ship at the first sign of any kind of difficulty.
Sure. I mean, friends, it takes work, even though, you know, work sounds like drudgery, but it's work, Raina.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking to a therapist with Marissa and me, who's like watches. I know Virginia Goldner because I watch Couples Therapy religiously.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, it's a great show. Yes.
And, you know, it's like, well, yeah, relationships are work. Where do we get the idea that they're not work? Human beings are really complex. This is why there are entire fields of science that are dedicated to trying to understand human beings. And, I think that we're really setting ourselves up for loneliness, for disconnection, if we think that everything is supposed to be simple and that people are going to read our minds. I mean, so much of the research that Marissa is talking about is about our sort of fundamental misunderstanding of what other people think about ourselves. So, you know, why do we think that we can let things go unsaid when we're not very good at you know, projecting ourselves into other people's minds or for other people to read what's going on with us. So, yeah, it's going to take some communication, indeed, some self-insight.
Yeah. And just to underscore that, Marissa, what Raina was saying is that, and I heard you say this, is we don't often know ourselves very well, much less, you know, people in our lives.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Absolutely. Like understanding, I think, in conflict, like where is this coming from? What's the deeper root of the pain instead of just blaming and attacking the other person, right? Like actually doing conflict right requires us to know ourselves and be able to share vulnerably with the other person. But as we're having this conversation, I'm thinking more broadly because my book is on attachment styles and how they intersect with friendship. And you could be anxiously attached where you cling close and want everyone to get very close to you because you're afraid of abandonment, or avoidantly attached where you push everyone away and you kind of deny having emotions or you deny emotions in other people. And it kind of makes me think that we have this kind of anxious attachment to romantic partnerships, that we need it and it makes our life complete and it makes us whole and we just want to get closer and closer. And this avoidant attachment to friendship, that let's deny that it's important at all. Let's trivialize it. Let's not have conflict. Let's ignore it. And it's wild to me that we're interpreting these different relationships, which are simply different forms of intimacy to me rather than one being inherently superior to the other, in this way that makes that then true because it changes our approach to those relationships.
Well, and I'm looking at an article that you wrote for The Atlantic about attachment and this description of so-called super friends, but what they have, it's not anxious or avoidant, it's secure attachment.
Yes. So people that feel secure in themselves, they're more likely to initiate friendships, better at working through conflict, just doing better in friendship overall. And part of the reason is that when you feel secure, right, that part of how you feel about yourself translates into how you think other people perceive you. So the better I feel about myself, the better I think other people perceive me. So this whole tip of assuming people like you, right, that comes a lot more naturally when you're securely attached. You think other people are going to like you. And that kind of belief translates into you being able to take all of the risks that are inherent to intimacy, initiating with someone, bringing up that conflict, being vulnerable with someone, showing affection because you don't think they're going to be rejected back at you. So our sense of self certainly bleeds into our ability to form relationships with other people. And in fact, I'm writing a book now on worthiness and actually finding that people that feel unworthy prefer interacting with people that disapprove of them. Because if people approve of them too much, they think it's only a matter of time till they find out the real me. And now I'm going to have to fall from grace. It triggers so much anxiety. So we also need to be able to do the work on ourselves that allows us to tolerate and turn towards healthy relationships.
Raina, you interviewed a number of people for your book, including Linda Collins and Natasha Bacht. They have a really interesting relationship that it does involve a child that one of them had. But it raises questions about if we're going to prioritize and give friendship the support and credit that it deserves, do we need to also bring the legal system in so that people have rights as friends? And I think one can imagine that could be a very fraught situation or one that could really bring some clarity to these relationships.
What I think comes up in Natasha and Linda's story, which I can give a little background on actually first. So Natasha decided to have a child on her own in her mid-30s, and her friend and coworker Linda, who she honestly was not that close to at the time, decided and offered to be her birth coach. And once the baby was born, fell totally in love with him and was there, you know, all the time trying to take care of him, and was very much welcomed by Natasha and her family. And eventually she wanted to get legal rights because she realized that they were legal strangers to each other. So if something went wrong with Natasha, she would have no say over what happens to this child. And she also couldn't kind of extend her pension benefits if she passed away or her health care to him, which was really important because he has a series of complex disabilities. And what their relationship highlights is the way that it's not so much like romance and sex that matters for functioning as good co-parents, but other features like intimacy, like trust and reliability. And, you know, where this fits into the legal system is that we only recognize one kind of intimacy, one, you know, form of commitment, which is really tied up with sexual contact and romantic sure. love. And, you know, I think rather than maybe trying to create a whole new class of legal recognition for friends, it's, I would be more interested in trying to open up our ideas about, you know, who the state should care about, and honoring all kinds of commitment and intimacy, not just if there's a sexual component. And, you know, it really makes a difference when there is a kid in the picture.
Yeah, putting that kid, I guess, front and center, and going on from there. That's a whole hour we could do, Raina, but I'm looking at the clock here, and I have a couple of more questions. In fact, Marissa, if I can go back to you. Again, broadly speaking, do men and women approach friendship differently? Do they look for different features from their friends?
Oh, man, the difficult terrain of men's friend. I didn't even know how different it was till I wrote this book. And
really?
I was like, wow, I can't believe your social worlds tend to be so different than ours, speaking in generalizations, at least.
Of course.
But what we see in the research is that men tend to be about half as likely to be vulnerable with their friends in a given week than women, half as likely to express affection in a given week than women. What I see in my class is that for women, actually, romantic and platonic love overlap a lot more. Like, women will cuddle with friends, hold hands, say I love you, be really vulnerable. Whereas for men, there just tends to be such a compartmentalization. Like, oh, that's a romantic partner who I even hug, right? Like, I see some men are like, we can only dap, who they can be vulnerable with, who they can say I love you to, but they don't necessarily do any of these behaviors with their friends. And you know, I see what happens when heterosexual couples get married, whereas women tend to maintain their friendships, men tend to really lose out and leave those friendships behind. And I think part of the reason is they're not actually accessing the full spectrum of intimacy that they can with their friends. So it feels like they're losing less. Of course, over time, that creates tension in heterosexual relationships. It makes them more vulnerable when, you know, their spouse is not around, or God forbid, their spouse passes away. And so I am... you know, I think that this is obviously a huge issue in general, that we don't value friendship and community, but I see the ways in which men are even more vulnerable.
And sports is not a substitute for vulnerability?
You know, sports, I won't say it doesn't provide you something. You have that repeated interaction, you have that camaraderie, you have that overlapping identity, that shared teamwork, and that's really valuable. But, you know, one thing, I talked to my brother about this difference, and he was like, you know, when we're in high school, right, like, men tend to really rely on these structures to stay connected, like we're on the same sports team, whereas women learn to not rely on them. They learn to say, let's hang out, even outside of our extracurriculars, outside of our school time. And this really tends to follow us. When men don't have that infrastructure, they're not intentionally pumping energy into friendships, whereas women tend to still do that.
How do you see that, Raina?
Well, I'm thinking of one of the men I interviewed for the book, who is straight, and he, as he got really close to one of his, to this very close friend of his, and who he has really a life partnership with, he started to wonder if he was gay, because he had never experienced emotional intimacy like that with a friend before. It had only ever come with a woman. And his friend, who himself is gay, was sort of asking him questions to figure out, like, you know, are you actually attracted to men? And it was just no, that he liked hugging his friend. Mm. He missed him when he was far away. And I think the experience of this guy, Nick, really speaks to how much is not on the table for straight men in particular with friendship, and how rarely they're actually experiencing emotional intimacy, which is, you know, very accessible in friendship, or it should exist. There's no reason why it shouldn't, but that for a lot of straight men, it would become too close to feeling like a romantic relationship to, you know, even contemplate. At least in Nick's case, he wasn't totally spooked by the possibility that it could, you know, indicate something about his sexuality. But I think for a lot of straight men, they don't even want to get that close, where they have to start, you know, disentangling, like, do I, you know, what exactly do I feel about this man? And instead, they just pour all of their kind of emotional needs into the women that they date or marry.
Well, and we're almost out of time, Marissa, but I'm thinking of male-female friendships, which certainly do exist. I have male friends. And,
yay.
You know, yay, exactly. I'm very happy about it. But at the same time, you know, you get a different worldview. You get different perspectives on things. That's got to be good.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, I certainly think that these friendships can provide a lot more value to our lives, even though they just tend to be more fragile than same gender relationships. I think we have this unfortunate perception that if I'm in a relationship, heterosexual and in a relationship, if my partner develops other friendships of the same gender, they're a threat to me, rather than this should be normal. Like, we're just connecting outside of our relationship. And, you know, we almost assume just like sexual interest so readily in our society, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even, you know, wanting to work through something with a friend, it's like, oh my gosh, is that because you're like really into them and we're really attracted to them? And it really limits our ability to have intimacy cross gender, and also to just kind of fully experience the platonic love in our friendship, because we're like, oh, if I love this friend of a different gender too much, then that might indicate that there's something sexual going on. Like, I think we just need space to acknowledge that, hey, platonic love can be deep, and it can be profound, and it can hit us, and it can hurt us. And this is all very, very normal.
Well, I so appreciate both of you joining us today on The Connection to talk about friendship. Marissa Franco, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And again, her book is Platonic, The Surprising New Science of How to Make and Keep Friends as Adults. Raina Cohen, thank you very much as well.
So happy to have had this conversation.
Yeah, me as well. And again, her book is The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of The Connection. Debbie Builder is the senior producer of the show. Paige Murray-Bessler, the show's producer. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.